I'm speaking today with Representative Sylvester Reyes, who represents the 16th Congressional District in El Paso. Representative Reyes, thank you very much for speaking to me today. You've been in Congress since you were first elected in 1996. Tell me kind of briefly, what would you say are the highlights of your career in Congress, the things you're most proud of?
Well, I think the one thing that I'm proud of throughout my tenure in Congress, and I tell this to many people, it probably is the constituency services that we provide here in the office. You know, we have people that need help with Social Security, with Medicare, with Medicaid, some other aspect of housing. So I think the day-to-day work that we do is vitally important, and that's why I'm most proud of having a staff that gets that job done and gets the job done for benefits of the people that come in with issues or with problems. The other thing that I'm proud of is that when I got elected in '96, within the first 3 months of my first term, we found out that Fort Bliss, which is a major employer here in West Texas, was in jeopardy of being closed in the next BRAC round. So we immediately went to work and developed a strategy to solidify its worth to the national security of our country. When the BRAC round finally came in 2005, Fort Bliss became the facility that gained the most in that BRAC round. Between the BRAC and the time that I found out about Fort Bliss being in jeopardy, we have to solve the perception that Fort Bliss was in an area that was going to run out of water. We had to coalesce and partner with the El Paso Chamber, the Las Cruces Chamber, and the Alamogordo Chamber. All of them were key players in the strategy, because Fort Bliss is contiguous to White Sands, and actually about 89% of Fort Bliss is in New Mexico. So getting those two partners was very important. And it also resolved the issue of many lawsuits being filed about water. We built the largest inland desalinization plant in the world, which put us, I think, over the hump in terms of the issue of water. We continue to showcase a facility that that Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta, in January when he visited us, said Fort Bliss was now the premier post in the country. So there are many other things. You know, you get to work on a lot of other things, but I'll just leave it at those two.
All right. You have served quite a bit on the Armed Forces Committee. You were the chair of the, and you've been the chair of the House Intelligence Committee. Right now, as part of the budget deal that was struck last year, Congress is supposed to, you know, find some cuts to defense spending, although it looks like the Republicans don't want to do that. Talk to me a little bit about this, you know, the process by which, you know, some, I think, $500 billion is supposed to be cut from defense over the next 10 years. What do you see happening there?
Well, the Secretary had already accepted the cutbacks of, $462 billion over a 10-year span. What we're most concerned about now are the automatic cuts that kicked in when that committee of 12 that was set up by the Budget Control Act, which, by the way, I opposed. I voted against it, so I want to make sure you know that. It gave the authority to 12 people in Congress to try to come up with solutions that I felt all members of Congress ought to weigh in. And when they failed, that kicked in the fallback cuts under sequestration, which is why we're trying to find a way to either change the law as it refers to those cuts, or come to an agreement where whatever money is agreed upon, that the Secretary of Defense would be able to make those decisions and not across-the-board cuts that would affect every aspect of the military budget, and including the regular budget items as well, the entitlement programs. So very dangerous when you look at our national defense and you look at the challenge we're living in worldwide today. There are still people trying to get into the U.S. to harm us. So I think it's a bad idea. I am also on public record as opposing downsizing the Army to 490,000. I just don't think it's a good idea when we're looking at the potential flare-ups in Iran, Syria. We're still in Afghanistan. We don't know exactly where we're going with Iraq yet. So I just think it's very bad policy to cut back at a time like that.
Well, obviously the budget, the defense spending is a significant part of the budget, and it's unclear, I guess, whether we should be spending all the amount that we are on defense now. What do you favor in terms of, spending on defense going forward? Keeping in mind both, obviously our needs, but also, the amount of money that we have to spend on other things as well.
Sure, and that's why I support giving the Secretary of Defense the authority to find places to cut back. Really, that's a fundamental difference between Democrats and Republicans, because Republicans will always want to deploy a Star Wars missile defense system, which is very costly. The technology hasn't been completely proven yet. In terms of national missile defense, I believe that the NATO nations, the Europeans, and a lot of the nations along the Mediterranean should pony up for their defense systems, whether it's missile or otherwise. So, getting back to your question, I think there are areas where we can cut in the defense budget, but that decision should be left up to the Secretary of Defense and not be a mandated sequestration 18% to 22% across the board.
Okay. What are we doing in Afghanistan these days? What's the case against trying to prioritize getting out?
That's a very important question that more and more people are asking, especially in lieu of an individual that repeatedly tries to ride the fence. Karzai has not been, I think, this is my opinion, has not been a reliable partner. We have known for some time that he has been having back-channel discussions with the Taliban. We need to understand exactly what his expectations are, because a huge difference between Iraq and Afghanistan is the educational level of its people. The people in Afghanistan can barely function at first grade level. In fact, our training right now is trying to bring that level up to a third grade level. And that just gives you a sense of the challenge when 10 warlords can have control of different parts of the country and dictate to a population exactly what they can and can't do. That's that's a real challenge. That's part of why I think there's a frustration building that maybe we shouldn't be there spending all these billions of dollars. And that's something from a policy perspective that we're going to have to deal with.
Okay. You were, as I said, the chair of the House Intelligence Committee, and I think if there's one area in which, you know, progressive Democrats have been really disappointed in the Obama administration, it's in matters of, you know, intelligence and national security, things like warrantless wiretapping, executive power, you know, the Guantanamo is still open, you know, the recent policy about, you know, being able to assassinate, you know, even American citizens abroad who are classified as terrorists. You know, do you foresee any of this changing direction anytime soon? How do you feel about some of these things?
Well, first and foremost, I know the president, because having been the chair of the Intelligence Committee, I had an opportunity to work directly with the president and his national security advisors over all of these areas and jurisdictions and challenges. First of all, I know the president wants to shut down Guantanamo. The reason he has not been able to is because we don't have a system in place that will guarantee that some of these really bad actors, and there's about 166 that are sworn enemies against the United States. And in order to close Guantanamo, we would have to move these guys either back to their home country or to a country that would be willing to take them. First of all, there aren't many takers as far as countries willing to take these guys, because that would be an instant national security problem for them. Secondly, even when we talk to countries that these people come from, they don't want them in their respective country. They're such a threat, such an international threat. So that's the major reason why we haven't been able to close Guantanamo. And you probably have been following the fact that Republicans are all, not all, but mostly all, are in favor of keeping Guantanamo open to put quote-unquote future terrorists in there. The issue of the authorities under wiretapping and surveillance and other things is something that I've worked firsthand with. I can tell you we have done a very good job of building in checks and balances. These authorities have to go through the FISA court. These authorities are closely monitored. People that are investigated under these authorities in the United States have certain rights that are still guaranteed to them. Now, that is dramatically different from U.S. citizens that are living abroad and are part of organizations and are actively trying to send in either operatives or some types of weapons and things that will harm the United States. That's the category that Alan Locke fell into, that I think you were referring to when you said the president has assassinated a U.S. citizen abroad. The case of Al-Awlaki, while it's somewhat complex, I think the president did the right thing. He had taken numerous actions to try to impact U.S. national security. And so it's good to have a discussion, it's good to have a debate about it, but these are times where we've had to make certain changes in the way that we operate because it's an asymmetric threat, because it's not going after conventional enemy forces, and because people in organizations like Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and others have no problem with sending suicide bombers. So it dramatically changes the national security scope.
Okay. Let's talk about border security and immigration. You were a border security, a border patrol agent before you were elected to Congress. What does border security look like these days? How good a job is the U.S. doing, and you know what should we be doing more of or less of?
Well, first and foremost, I think President Obama has done a great job. When I retired from the Border Patrol, and I was a chief in McAllen, which is down South Texas, and then in El Paso, I'm the one that devised the Hold the Line strategy, which moves agents right up on the border and eliminates all the chaos of chasing people through communities and schools and all of that. So President Obama has done a great job. Today, when I retired, there were 5,600 Border Patrol agents nationwide. Today, there are about 21,800. When I retired in El Paso as chief, I had 1,000 agents. Today, that number is pretty close to 3,000. I think we've done a great job in between the ports of entry. President Obama deserves the credit of providing that kind of border security. What we haven't kept up with has been the ports of entry. Ports of entry today were designed decades ago. The infrastructure today is not conducive to routing commercial and car traffic through a system that uses technology. I've introduced legislation that would do three things. First of all, it would spend $1 billion a year on infrastructure, and that infrastructure would align the ports of entry to function to 21st century standards. The second part is my legislation authorizes and hires 1,000 inspectors at those ports of entry. Today, nationwide, we've got about a 33% vacancy rate, which means long lines at the land border ports, waiting times at the ports of entry along the coast, and also at the airport. So we need to hire 5,000 inspectors during a five-year period. The reason it's 1,000 a year is because that's the capacity of the training academy. So we need to shift the focus from in between the ports of entry, where President Obama should take credit for the great job that he's done there, to the ports of entry to help facilitate trade and commerce here 10 years after NAFTA was passed. So we've got infrastructure money, we've got inspectors, the one component, which is the third one that I put in there, are agricultural inspectors. Today we're importing agricultural products year-round from, not just from Mexico, but from Central and South America. At the same time, we've lost the technical expertise of agricultural inspectors. So my legislation hires 1,200 inspectors for agriculture specialists for that five-year period. So I guess to encapsulate the issue of border security, we're doing much better post 9/11 than pre 9/11. We've hired up Border Patrol agents to protect in between the ports of entry, and we're now, I think, should be focusing on those ports of entry. The importance of the legislation that I introduced is that whenever we have an opportunity, and I'll give you one example, whenever we have an opportunity, it's good to have legislation that's been introduced and is pending before committees, and in some cases has already had a number of committee hearings that we can draw from and plug into, you know, a lesser amount that may be considered. We had such an opportunity in December of 2010 when we had the Border Enforcement Act, which gave $600 million towards border enforcement. We got out of that money, we got, I think it was 79 inspectors, 78, 79, I forget the actual number, but that's one of the byproducts of, and values of the legislation that I just spoke about. It's called the putting our resources to work towards security, or for short, it's ports. The Ports Act. And by the way, it's been endorsed by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Border Trade Alliance, the Foreign Trade Association, the Mayor's Coalition, the Border Counties Coalition as well. So it's got pretty broad-based support, but we haven't moved it forward simply because the Republicans are always asking for offsets, and you have to find offsets for the $1 billion for infrastructure and also the salaries for the inspectors.
All right, and I presume you're opposed to the offsets. You think that these should just be paid for by themselves, right?
Well, you know, I think offsets are fine, but there's a little bit of hypocrisy that goes on here. When the Democrats were in charge, we had to do the pay for, which meant we had to find the money to pay for programs like this. When the Republicans got control of the House, they immediately eliminated the pay for provision. Now, because of the deficit and the debt, now they're saying nothing will move unless there's an offset. And interestingly enough, the offsets always hit the entitlement programs.
Yeah, that is how they operate, isn't it? Let's talk about immigration reform. What does comprehensive immigration reform look like to you? And, you know, what hope do we actually have of getting something like that passed?
Well, I don't see immigration reform being passed between now and November. I think when we're successful in reelecting President Obama, I think that'll be his top priority. And let me just give you a couple of takes on comprehensive immigration reform. I have said that it's imperative that we pass comprehensive immigration reform because it's a national security issue. And the reason it is because we've got a shadow world of 9 to 12 million people living in our country, creating this shadow world where terrorists or other people can move through pretty much at will. And that's a national security issue. What does comprehensive immigration reform look like? First and foremost, it's got to have a provision that allows people to come out of the shadows and self-identify. So it's a legalization component. This is where the Republicans criticize us about amnesty. I'm not one that runs away from the word amnesty. I think it's imperative that we pass this first provision because that's the only way we're going to get people to come out and identify themselves and reduce that shadow world that I was talking about. Secondly, I think another component has to be a guest worker program that helps in bringing in workers that work largely in areas where Americans won't work. But if we've learned anything from the draconian laws that were passed in Alabama and Georgia, it's that it puts farmers out of business, because you can't pay, even if they, in some cases they were offering $20 an hour to pick agricultural products, and people just they turned out initially, and then they said, no, this work is too hard. So I think a guest worker provision is important as well.
Okay. You've been through redistricting a couple of times. How did this time compare to the previous times?
Well, you know, the previous time, I think you're referring to the chaos created by Tom DeLay.
Oh, that's one of them, yeah.
I mean, that cost Texas dearly, because we lost, I think it was 124, 134 years of seniority. We lost five people because of Tom DeLay that would have been chairs when we took back the House in the election of 2006. So consequently, I was the only full committee chair for Texas, and that obviously, when you have chairs from your state, that creates participation of the agenda. It gives the state more power. So that is still fresh in my mind, of the way that Tom DeLay impacted and hurt Texas with his redistricting at a mid 10-year period. He was after full and complete control of the, and permanent control of the House of Representatives for Republicans. He wound up hurting Texas pretty badly. As it relates to this one, well, you know what? Our primary date was supposed to be in early March. We finally got a date of the 29th of May. That has played chaos with congressional elections and state elections and others. The fact that we had, I think, 27 maps that were considered is a little indicative of how chaotic that was. But I'm glad it settled, and I'm glad we've got a primary date, and now we just have to get through that and then prepare for the general election.
If after the primary, President Obama says he wants to come down to the 16th district and campaign with you, what would you tell him you'd like for him to talk about in the district?
Why have you waited so long? He's been here several times. In fact, he gave his national speech on immigration right here at the Chamisal Park, and I would be proud to campaign with the president. I've supported his jobs agenda. I know that he's had a hard time finding partners on the other side of the aisle, but the economy needs to get going. Economists have told us repeatedly at our conference that the best antidote for the debt, the deficit, and the doldrums that are worldwide in their markets, the best medicine is a robust U.S. economy. I was proud to have voted for Obamacare. I don't run away from that title. I think it's perfect, because my district had about 233,000 people that had no health care insurance. So I was proud to vote for it. I think it's historic legislation. And then the third issue that I know is important to him is education. And education will give us the ability to really move forward as a nation. And by the way, I don't know if you're going to ask me about the Ryan budget, but I think the Ryan budget sucks. I think it cuts and jeopardizes Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid. Those are programs they've always been after. And I would not vote for such a budget under any circumstances.
What would be your priorities for the next term if you're reelected?
Well, as you probably know, the administration has asked for the authority to do another BRAC round, maybe two. So with my seniority on the Armed Services Committee, I'm the second most senior Democrat on the Armed Services. That would be huge for us, because whether or not people think it's a political process, it still is a political process. And seniority helps immensely with the possibility of another BRAC round. I also will continue to focus in working with the president on jobs and improving the economy. I think all the economic indicators are pointing in a positive direction. Want to be able to continue to work in fine-tuning the Health Care Act. And, of course, my other priority was always, has always been education.
Okay. And, you know, you do have, I guess, two opponents, I believe, in this primary. When people go to vote on May 29th, why should they vote to send you back to represent District 16 for a ninth term and not one of your opponents?
Well, I actually have, I think, four opponents.
Well, I'm just talking about in the primary. I'm aware of two. Yeah. Maybe I'm miscounting.
In the primary, I have four opponents.
Oh, wow. All right. I guess I've lost track. Sorry about that.
Yeah. Yes. But let me tell you, I have a track record that I'm proud of. I told you about Fort Bliss. I told you that my main priority always is constituency services. I'm a veteran. Veteran health care is important to me. I'm also the second senior member on the Veterans Committee. I'm the only member of Congress with a background in border security and border enforcement. So I'm proud of the track record that I've built over these 15 years. In addition to that, I think my voting record reflects the priorities and the values of this district. One of my opponents talks about means testing Social Security. That is the worst possible thing. I will not give an inch on Social Security, Medicare, or Medicaid. Those are important and vital to serving all of El Paso. And that's the other thing that I will tell my constituents is that I speak on behalf of everyone in El Paso. I give voice to everyone in El Paso, and I'm proud and honored to represent them.
Okay. Representative Sylvester Reyes, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Very good. Well, listen, thank you. And if you have anything else, just give us a call. Give Claudia a call.
Thank you.